Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan. And for this episode of Ecologic, we're joined by John Perlin. He has just updated a book called A Forest Journey, The Role of Trees in the Fate of Civilization. Excited to have a discussion with John today. Hey, John, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fine, despite the fact that the sun isn't shining today.
We've had a lot of rain in California.
We have.
And you're in Santa Barbara right now, which, of course, a few years ago, you had those awful mudslides.
Oh, yeah. Well, I actually appreciate them because I like to go fossil hunting. And the more slide you have, the more rock you have to look at for fossils.
So you're really looking for the very best in what for many people is a disaster.
Right. I mean, it's my day in the flood. Some people have a day in the sun. I have a day in the flood.
How long have you lived in the Santa Barbara area?
About 30 years.
And before that, you were, as we were talking, you were born and raised in Los Angeles, right?
Born and raised in LA, and so was my parents, and so were my grandparents.
So where did you go? Talk about your youth. Where did you go to college? What were you thinking about?
Well, actually, I began my interest in trees when I was 11 years old, and I there was this contest for kiddie kids in the funny papers, comics. It was called Ask Andy. And I asked the question, if a seed is so small, why are trees so tall? And that won me the first book of trees.
Really? Really?
Really, really.
So now we're going to get more into this when we get into the discussion. I've had you very much pegged in my mind as an expert on the history of solar power, which you are, because that's one of the great books that you've done. But it sounds like trees were really even more fundamental to your environmental roots.
Well, actually, the solar book is what my work in solar history is what led me into the forest book, because every time people turn to like solar architecture in antiquity, I found the reason was they were running out of wood. So finding this happening in the Roman times, Greek times, ancient Chinese times, I asked the question, wood must have been pretty important for societies to heat their homes for, the primary fuel. So it must have played a major role in society, just as fossil fuels have played a major role in our society today. And so that led me on to the research, which culminated in the book you have right now.
Yeah, so let's just jump right to that, and we can kind of back and forth in the timeline. But here I've got your new book, The Forest Journey. Now, this is 500 pages or 400 plus pages of
it's 500 pages.
500 pages of pithy, pardon the pun, information about trees. And this is This is an updated version, right? You came out with this originally in 1989, is that right?
Correct. But the real difference is one is access to the internet. There wasn't an internet back then. And two, I'm a member of the University of California, Santa Barbara, and they have a digital collection of journals that they didn't have before. And so much has happened in forestry in the last 30 years, and also all the new scholarship in the ancient world has, grown too. The book is basically a very enlarged version. It's 100 pages, 150 pages more than previous edition, and it includes much more. For example, the original book went back only 5,000 years. This book goes back 385 million years with the first true tree, which was discovered after the first edition was published.
Is that right? Yeah, and I was fascinated by that. I read about that the tree, and I'll butcher the name, but it's Archaeopteris or something like that.
Yes, you got a trophy for pronunciation.
Okay. And you said 385 million years ago, and I was fascinated by this as I skimmed through parts of the book, that 385 million years ago, this tree had properties where it would absorb CO2 and I guess it's sort of more accelerated photosynthesis, and therefore the CO2 levels in the environment came down, or the oxygen levels came up to a point that would support life as we know it.
Well, actually, its deep roots played a more important role than photosynthesis, which is what trees re how really how trees really take down the CO2 is the roots of a tree. You might say gather the supplements, the vitamins that a tree requires, like calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and not all of that those supplements are used by the tree. Like it's like leaving food on the table after dinner. Like you don't eat all the lima beans, for example, and which I didn't when I was a kid. And so what happens is that those leftovers go back into the soil. They combine with the rainwater, which is basically diluted carbon dioxide, and they lock in the carbon dioxide as a carbonate, and that becomes like calcium carbonate, which is limestone. It flows down from the soil to the rivers to the sea and gets locked in as limestone, and there you have your sequestered carbon dioxide.
Fascinating, fascinating. So now, for some reason, that tree species 385 million years ago played this pivotal role on our planet.
It did, and one of the reasons it played that role was it was the first true tree, and its roots, like I said, and the photosynthesis together work able enabled the beginning of the great takedown of carbon dioxide on the planet. You can see a huge increase of oxygen and a huge decrease of carbon dioxide with the advent of trees over the hundreds of millions of years. And so this shows the value of trees today, because these tr the first true tree was able to spread because there was only one continent, one huge continent called Gondwanaland. So there were no barriers to it spread throughout the terrestrial world. And this is why this first the fossils of this first true tree are found in Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, the Catskills in New York, Ireland, Morocco, South Africa and Australia, and all the way north to Spitsbergen, which is the big island in the Arctic Circle by Norway. So it's ubiquitous. It was ubiquitous everywhere in the ancient world.
And as you said, this was found out after you had written the original version back in 1989.
Right. In 1990, they had discovered 150 fossilized trunks in Morocco, and they were able to delineate from those very large fossils exactly the anatomy of that tree. And that's what it became known. Archaeopteryx became known as the first true tree. And ever since then, they've increased the amount of fossil discoveries. In fact, only 3 years ago, they discovered huge roots in the Catskills of New York. And I actually, if you can wait a second, I can run and get you, because I actually, one of my ways of doing research to make it really feel like I really understand it is to put my boots on and go. And so for 2 weeks, I dug fossils of Archaeopteryx, and I have, for example, charcoal remains from the first because the tree increased the oxygen so much that for the first time on the planet, ignition was possible. So you had the first forest fires. And I have those remains of they're like charcoal from 385 million years ago. And if you rub your finger on on the charcoal, it smudges as if it were a forest, if it were a campfire yesterday.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So to talk, tell the story of how Patagonia came into your life, because you'd written this book, years ago. You'd updated, I think, one other time, but then I believe it was the Patagonia folks that came to you and said, we'd like you to really do a significant update.
Well, the local newspaper, the Santa Barbara Independent, carried a story of a symposium I was leading on the. It was the first symposium ever done on this woman who discovered that in 1856 that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas in 1856. And also, she wrote that in the leading scientific journal of the day that if there was more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the Earth would become a lot hotter. And so I conducted this symposium on her, and the local newspaper carried a whole story about the symposium. And Patagonia, being only 25 miles away, read it. And they immediately sent an email to the editor that they wanted to do a version of a forest journey for about a decade, but they didn't know where the hell I was. And suddenly, all the big wigs of Patagonia came to a restaurant with me in Santa Barbara, and we worked this a deal out. And what was really funny was I really, really, really pissed them off because, and this is how I do my work, I constantly make new discoveries. My mind is just that kind of mind, and I'm never satisfied until I think I've worn every route out. And so I'd constantly send to the editor, this is the last update. And then a week later I have another update. And and so but then what happened is they came to me at a restaurant was and said, we want to give you 6 more months to write because we want you to do even more updates. And so what I'd like to say that the what includes in the new book is, for example, an amazing discovery in Africa that the Africa considered like the the dark continent where only the white people have brought its civilization, actually were producing from iron ore steel 1,000 years before the Europeans. And this, of course, required tremendous amounts of wood to smelt the metal. And the thesis of a forest journey is that civilizations have depended in times past basically on wood because it's their primary fuel, primary building material. No wood, no ships, no wood, no fuel to get into the Middle Ages, for example.
Right, and I want to talk. I want to hear some more examples of how civilizations have depended on wood. You called in the book, you called wood what humanity's most essential material, and
Well,
I call it unsung hero. I like the unsung hero concept.
well, it's true. I mean, just think of it. First of all, had Archaeopteryx not shown up, we no creatures of very large size could have ever come onto terrestrial Earth because of the fact that there wasn't sufficient oxygen to metabolize until this first tree began the you might say the oxidation of the atmosphere. And also the temperatures were too hot, and the decarbonization of the atmosphere, and they call them a large vascular plants, which are trees, and which was Archaeopteryx, brought this down and created a livable Earth for you and me.
Right.
So just in that fact, there would be no humans on this earth if not for the trees taking all this carbon out and putting all this oxygen in. And now what we're doing is by burning fossil fuels, these trees were like, the big, you know, trunks got buried in the earth. And so it sequestered the carbon for hundreds, if not tens of hundreds of millions of years. So it kept all this CO2 out. And so what do we humans do is we dig it up and burn it, and we reverse the process which Archaeopteryx began.
Right. And then, I mean, compounding the issue, like you said, over the past 12,000 years, 50% of the world's forests have been cut down.
Precisely. And the majority began 5,000 years ago with the first civilized area called Uruk, which is located in the Fertile Crescent. And that's when you began the major destruction of the woods throughout the world.
And why, and John, why is that? I mean, you must have a sort of a personal theory or belief that why is it that man sees a beautiful forest and instead of taking what he or she needs, cuts the whole shooting match down?
Because people, we call it hubris, where you want to be the, I don't know, you have kids. Did you ever read them Yertle the Turtle?
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, it's I call it the Yertle the Turtle complex, where, you know, the king of the turtles wanted to have a good view because all the land he could see belonged to him. So what he did is he piled turtle over turtle over turtle so he could, like, be the top turtle, right? And that's the story of humanity. Someone wants to be the top turtle, and so they need to, you know, build. Like, and that's what happened actually in Uruk, which was the first civilized city, is Gilgamesh wanted to be the King Turtle, right? And so he went out and did what was called the forest journey, where he led his men to the great cedar forest. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that in the mountains above Iraq, were once equivalent to the redwoods, and cut down the cedar forest to build a great city where his name would persist for, you know, infinity.
And there just was no, it was just still a frontier mentality, I guess. There was no sense of forest practices, of forest management, that we would need these resources over time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we believe that the frontier is basically an American experience. What I discovered in doing a forest journey, that a frontier is a universal experience, where, for example, Greece, for example, looked to Rome for its woods. Rome looked to France, North Africa, and England for its woods. England looked to North America for its woods. And so it's been a continuous process over the thousands of years, because wood is essential for one, shipbuilding. Until the Merrimack and the Monitor, the two ironclads, went to it in 1862, every ship was made of wood. And if you didn't have wood, you didn't have ships. And if you didn't have ships, you didn't have sea power to conduct trade. For example, in England, they called it the wooden walls of England is what made England great. And England then ran out of wood, and they saw all these great forests in North America, and they said, let's go for it, right? Because we want to be the King Turtle.
And were we, at that time, was, you know, large amounts of wood, of timber, were being actually exported from North America back to Europe?
For example, the masting trees, the great white pines of New England, which is almost a joke now, because, you know, there, you know, no one can even conceive that in New England they had, you know, trees commensurate to the redwoods growing from northern Massachusetts all the way up to Maine. And so the English, because they had these ships that had 200, 300 guns, so you had to have great masts to stabilize a ship. And so the masting timber from New England became imperative for the continuation of the English Empire. And that's what led to revolution, because the Americans started to say, well, if England needs to take our wood to be so great, why don't we just use our wood to be great ourselves?
Yeah.
So it's once again the year old the turtle effect, right? Everyone wants to be king, you know, king of the turtles.
Really, very, very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about forests and rainfall, because this was something that I had never thought about. And I think we were all taught in elementary school that rainfall is a result of ocean and lakes and waterways evaporating and creating clouds that ultimately result in precipitation. But I think you're saying in this book that a lot of rainfall is the result of forests and trees bringing that water up.
Well, I mentioned that one of the why I'm so happy that a new edition came out is the last 30 years has been revolutionary for discovering what trees really do. And one of the services they do for us, and also I may add how unappreciated they are, is that they discovered, and like you said, the stereotype is that all the water like bodies like lakes and ocean, the evaporation creates the rain. But two things is, one, it's been now concluded scientifically that trees create at least 40% of the local precipitation, but they also serve, and this is even more significant, they serve as relays for precipitation in distant areas. So for example, the Congo Basin provides the Nile with 40% of its water. Siberian and Scandinavian woods provide China with the majority of their precipitation. The Amazon provides Buenos Aires, for example, and Sao Paulo with the majority of their precipitation. You cut these trees down and there's no water. And last time I heard, water is very important.
But you're saying, when you're saying these are regional transfers, right? So that
right.
Somehow a forest in one region is going to put enough moisture up into the air that those clouds are going to travel to another region and dump the water? Is that
definitely?
That's what we're saying here.
And also what they believe too is, and this is the newest scholarship, is that it also creates a movement of atmosphere. And actually, the ocean evaporation would leave the rest of the world in desert if you didn't have the trees relaying the the precipitation that's caused by evaporation of the oceans over the land masses. Because once you got, if you had like a desert 500 miles in from the ocean, there would be no relaying of that precipitation, and the world would get very thirsty.
Right. Now, how do you raise awareness about that? I mean, we're talking about international, I mean, not just regional, we're talking international cooperation based on hydrologic cycles, and in this case, the role of trees. But how do you get, isn't there a lack of awareness in this area?
Well, that's why I wrote the book, and that's why we're having this show, is to inform people about what trees really do. And that's what I hope to get across, is one, we could have never had large animals on the earth with actually Archaeopteryx, what's really interesting, actually sort of like a magnet brought the first fish that had lungs and had like ability to walk on land. And enabled them to find a refuge from the, I don't know if you've ever seen the Devonian fish, like their one third jaw or something. And they have teeth that are, I have some teeth here from, the Devonian period that I dug from the Archaeopteryx finds, and allowed them to settle on Earth and were their descendants. So if not for Archaeopteryx, we wouldn't be having this show right now.
Right.
So just that alone should alarm people that, in fact, the end Permian extinction 100 million years after Archaeopteryx showed up, The deforestation created a situation where almost all land animals died. What happened was, as the trees died, there was not vegetation for the herbivores, and the herbivores died, and so the carnivores had no food, right? And so everything collapsed.
So are you then, given your knowledge of the value of trees in managing carbon on Earth, are you optimistic that we really, if we could get our act together, that we really do have the ecosystems in place that can toggle carbon dioxide levels down?
Well, I plan to be like John the Baptist, and I hope to spread the word of the importance of trees. And this is why I created in this new Patagonia book the whole story of how trees are even more important for the survival of civilization than they were in times past. So it's not a story of just what happened in the past, but it's actually a prediction of what can happen in the future if we don't get our act together and stay out of the forest.
How about how do you package this information? Now you've written this amazing tome, this huge Bible, encyclopedia, I guess would be a more appropriate way of putting
right.
it. Are there anybody taking and putting out an abbreviated version of this?
Actually, Patagonia plans to do that. But I've been told, actually, the person who did the audiobook for Penguin Random House, he spent 30 hours reading this book for audiobook. He said, and I felt very complimented, that this was the nicest written book he's ever read. So what I tried to do, I don't know how you feel about it, but I tried to create a story in the words of the people in each time period that I gain from learning how to say wood, how to say pine tree, how to say oak in Latin, in cuneiform. You're familiar with cuneiform, you know, the first, it's like wedges in clay, the first written language, sure. And Greek, Latin, and, Spanish and Italian. So I could go to the lexicons and find out where all the information of trees were from primary sources to give the reader a feeling of people contemporary to each culture, how they felt about wood. For example, the Romans had a saying that, we say, as redundancy, getting coal, bringing coal to Newcastle, they had a saying, bringing timber to the forest.
Now, going all the way back in your career, is it true that you were also a professor of physics?
Not a professor of physics. What happened was, and this is the first edition of A Forest Journey, is there was a professor at UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, who I would take probably too much time. Let's say I met him on a bus and I gave him a review of the first edition. 3 weeks later, he called me up and said, "This is one of the 5 best books I've ever read." And 2 years later, he wins the Nobel Prize. And he invites me to be in the physics department. And he was the top physicist in the world, Dr. Walter Cohn. And we worked and in the physics department. We actually did a documentary called The Power of the Sun. It's called the history of the science of light and its relationship to photovoltaics. And we did multiple projects together, and he dubbed me like 9 years after he first brought me in as a physicist. And this is the top, this was the top gun in physics in the world. So here I am like dubbed, I'm not sure Sir John Perlin, but physicist John Perlin.
Well, you certainly have a grasp of some really big topics and big views of the world. It's been really delightful talking to you about it, John. I know you've got your bicycle there. You've told me that that is your sole means of transportation. How else do you keep balance? And how do you keep balance? You've got your brain is obviously going strong. How do you keep balance in your life?
Well, first of all, I actually have done some practical non-solar, non-wood things. Like I was a single parent, raised a boy who's now 32, who has his doctorate in organic chemistry from UCLA. So that was a balanced project. As a parent too, that will keep you on your toes in reality.
For sure.
You know, my kid, he's pretty convivial, and he's not a lab rat, but he's smart. And also I go out and fossil hunt. I love that. I found lots of petrified wood. I never imagined that there'd be petrified wood in Santa Barbara, and I found huge amounts of petrified wood in the rocks. And actually, 2 days ago, as I told you earlier, I'm one for more and more erosion, because that brings the rocks down to my grasp to open up and find new things. And that's actually what I've done throughout my life, is open up new rocks and finding knowledge that nobody thought existed. Like with the history of solar, at first when I embarked on that project, people would laugh and say, well, it's going to be really a thin book, right? And it turned out to be 480 pages. And then A Forest Journey opened up for me a whole new way of looking at the world, because if not for trees, you and I wouldn't be talking.
John, thanks so much. You've enlightened me, and you've enlightened our listeners. So thanks again. And we're going to have another conversation about Let It Shine, the 6,000 year history of the solar industry.
Well, I'd love to do that. You know, I'm here, and the paperback just came out like about 8 months ago.
Very good. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.